We have all the money to do everything we're supposed to do and we didn't do it well.
Can you expand more on that?
Nollywood is born out of just pure grit. Most of the practitioners there are either using their own money, hanging on, doing it afraid, doing it broke, doing it scrambling. I've heard of filmmakers who have sold properties, cars, things to produce. And you ask, why? Why are you still doing that? Passion.
And what gets you up every day to do it, though, despite everything?
Oh dear, you're going in deep quickly.
Omotola Jalade Ekainde, she arrived on the Nollywood scene in 1995. Known to the world as Omosexy, her career has broken records, defined eras, and made millions of African women feel seen, powerful, and unstoppable.
I was an only child for a very long time before my younger ones came along. And so when my dad died, just before I am able to process this as a child, then everybody's telling me, oh, you have to be strong for your mom. You have to be strong for your mom. So this is the big sister and mom. It was very weird for me. I didn't know how to process it. I didn't cry. Have I still, till this day, mourned my dad? I don't think so.
You've said once that divorce is not an option. How have you been able to fortify your marriage in such a way that no one can come and penetrate it?
I'm not against divorce. I just always believe that marriage is...
You're 48, 30 years in film, 30 years married, over 300 movies, Time 100, Oscar voted, UN ambassador, directorial debut at TIFF, 4 children, emergency surgery you survived. When you look at all of that, right, which Omotola are you proudest of?
What? I didn't expect that kind of a question.
We see the tweets. And every single day, what we see is we love Afropolitan. This podcast is underrated. This is the best podcast ever. But the problem is 82% of you are not subscribers, but I know you guys are watching. So I need you to click the subscribe button so you can join the Afropolitan family. Thank you.
Omotola. So someone's going to click your specific video. And they may be winding down from a long day. Maybe they're on their way to work. Maybe they're using this video as they're working out. Uh-huh. So the first thing I want you to tell the Afropolitan audience is a common misconception about Nollywood that most people don't know.
I'll say that we have all the money to do everything we're supposed to do and we didn't do it well. We don't.
Can you expand more on that?
So Nollywood is born out of just pure grit. Most of the practitioners there are either using their own money, sometimes family and friends. There's no real structure as to how to get money. There's no proof of concept. There's no, oh, your project did well the last time. So this is some, you know, funnel where we can measure the metrics and then you can get the money legitimately or whatever, you know, so everybody's just winging it. So most times you're exhausted, actually. You're just hanging on and doing it anyway, doing it afraid, doing it broke, doing it scrambling. I've heard of filmmakers who have sold properties, cars, things to produce. And you ask, why? Why are you still doing that? Passion. Passion. It's hard.
Yeah. And what gets you up every day to do it, though, despite everything? Because you're a veteran.
Yeah.
So what gets you still going after all these years?
I just always want to, it's legacy. I just always want to do something that hasn't probably been done before. I've always had a global vision. I feel like we're not still there yet. I want to keep pushing for that, irrespective of where we are, what people think, how they feel that we're progressing or not. I just want to keep going. And so I take time out to go refresh myself, find my motivation, and I come right back like a tigress.
True, because you have a movie coming, right? So I'm gonna get to that, but I wanna take this time to lay the groundwork, right? Because I mean, I think you've seen it all, right? Like I've seen over time, and I grew up with you, right? And so I think I first want to lay down, like, what's exciting you now about Nollywood? Like, is there like a new innovation or maybe a new way that's being delivered? What do you think is like, this is interesting?
Oh, that's very tough, to be honest. I'm not quite sure there's anything that excites me right at this moment. Sometimes it feels daunting still. It feels like, almost as if we haven't made real progress, because there was a time when we went into the streamers and then they left.
Yeah.
Very quickly, you know, so that's like, what happened? Hello. I blinked and you guys are gone. When I was shooting my movie, they were still here. By the time I was done with the movie, they were gone. I'm like, what am I supposed to do with this film now? Come back. But you know, so there's not too much to encourage you with. I think right now what we're looking two is the fact that with social media now, it's just easier to get to people. It's easier on, like, when we started, where you had to push everything manually, you know. It's just easier to get to people, at least personally for me, the fact that I now live abroad. I feel encouraged knowing fully well that I am building something elsewhere that I can also add to what I already have. So I think that for me, that's the most exciting thing. The fact that there's something new in my life that I am aspiring for, hoping for, holding on to, learning into, leaning into, you know? Yeah. For me, that's what it is. Well, otherwise, if I looked generally at what is happening really on the scene.
Actually, just speak to that, because, and it's interesting because we had a guest earlier that's also, you know, in the culture aspect, right? He's in fashion, you're in film. I'm curious, out of all the cultural pillars, right? I think the ones that have really exported and they continue and even export, import, I would say music, right? Why do you think film hasn't done that yet, full the way music has? What do you think is holding us back?
Mostly funding. Mm. Mostly funding. With music is not as expensive. Really, it isn't.
To create.
Yeah, it's not really that expensive to create, except if you want to shoot very lavish music videos and stuff like that, which most times these days I don't even do anymore, because really very easy viral content or ideas go farther than all the, you know, packaged billion-dollar budget videos anyway. So you notice that a lot of artists now just wing it. You know, they're just having fun in their house or, you know, just with friends, and then they record it and people are like, oh, it's so organic, it's so nice. Yeah, you can't do that with film, unfortunately. I mean, the cheapest movie would probably still have like 30 cast and crew. Like the most
minimum
would probably still have like 30 cast and crew. I mean, my film had basically like 6 main characters, but you don't want to. I mean, I remember I was at TIFF, someone said, like, you know, like, when is it going to end? Like, it just keeps going and going and going. The credits, you know, that's it. So just 6 people that are mainly cast in the movie. But then the credits, like, what? We had like almost 1,000 people working behind the scenes. It's a lot, you know. With music, you don't need that many people, you know. Also, don't forget that film is actually quite snobbish, generally. It's just what it is. Film is, they almost very serious, most, like, it's just on, I don't know, you know, so you can't easily collaborate with other people in other countries. It's almost like a clique, you know. Even with the Oscars, the way we're processed, you know, our films coming from outside, international films or whatever, you can't even get to maybe even present at the Oscars. Like, you're not even nominated. That's too much. We're just saying acknowledge other people from other countries so they can present awards. You can't even get that kind of acknowledgement even at the Oscars. So it is that intense. And so every, for example, even if you had the money to put in a Leonardo DiCaprio in your movie, he probably won't still come. You know why? Because it's thinking, who's the producer? Are they PGA? Who's the director? Are they DGA? Who are the other actors? Then he's thinking of his last box office numbers. Is this going to meet up? Is it going to bring down my rating? It's a lot. It's a lot. And then you have situations where even your government does not really understand what it takes to do movies on that level. So you're not getting that kind of support. There are no tax incentives. We don't have it. It's just a lot.
Yeah.
It's a lot that we still have to surmount for us to get to that point where we can actually start to do what Afrobeat is doing. They don't have to go through all these hurdles, really. You can just vibe with some artists, you know, they came visiting and you guys just, you know, somehow, you don't even need a studio these days. They could just be in the living room or whatever, or even in the car, and they're just vibing and, oh, they just bring out their phone and they record, and that's it. that's a hit right there. And then they're just going to, you know, they clean it up and everything. And before you know what's going on, it's out there. They start to promote it. And then they might do some, the video in the car might be the video. Yes, I mean the video for that song.
Yeah.
And next thing you hear is Grammy nominated.
It's true.
In fact,
the trending song now is the Nepo Baby.
Yes, the Nepo Baby
one. I don't know if they have a music video. Yeah, it's just them in the cars.
Yeah.
That's it. And just more people come out of cars, come out of cars. And that's the song.
It. That's it.
So, Motola, I've been looking forward to this conversation. I feel like, you know, I was so excited for this because it felt like manifestation.
Wow.
Because when we first started, like, you're thinking about, okay, who your dream guest to have, and you're saying, okay, one day, hopefully, Motola. So I'm definitely grateful that you're sitting on the couch. But I did want to set the tone because I think a big part of why people love tuning in is they get to understand what helped shape this person to make them who they are today. And then you also share the frameworks that other people can learn from as well. So I want to take it back to grief, right? And the first sort of grief you experienced with your dad passing at 12, right? You've talked a little bit about it in the past, but you've said that it shaped you both positively and negatively, right? Now that you've spent 30 years in the game and you can look back, and this is also advice because I also have friends now who are now losing loved ones, right? We're all getting older, and grief is one of those things that we're all learning to struggle with because nobody gave us the tools to grieve. Like I lost my grandma about like 3 years ago, and I realized later on, literally last year, that I hadn't grieved her until some random night, and the grief hit me like, wow, I'll never see her again, right? And you lost your dad at 12 years old. So I don't even know how it must have felt at that time. Can you walk us through what that period looked like for you? I know he was the Lagos Country Club manager at the time. I'm sure it was a good life. And you were in Kaduna at the time when you found out. So walk us through what that looked like.
Oh dear, you're going in deep quickly. Yeah, it was tough. I was just 12, like you said. And I was extremely close to my dad. I was an only child for a very long time before my younger ones came along. So I was with him most of the time. I was in Chrisland, so my school was very close to Lagos Country Club. So, you know, it was natural that they would pick me up from school and take me straight to the club to spend time with him and vice versa. So we grew a very intimate bond, him and I. And not with my mom, unfortunately. I didn't spend enough time with her to even have that bond. And the little time I would spend with her, she concentrated more on disciplining me. Mm-hmm. So as a child, I couldn't process that quite well. I thought, this woman hates me. Why? And I didn't like her either, you know. And so when my dad died, you know, going through the process of picking me up, and I knew someone had died in the family, the only prayer was, oh my God, let it be my dad. Mm. So strangely, as a child, and I got to the house, and with all the grief and everything, everybody saying sorry, I got in and I saw my mom. I was like, oh my God. And I saw my younger ones. I was like, oh God, it has to be him, right? So it's him. So from that minute, it hit me that, oh my God, is the one person I didn't want to leave that has left. But just before I am able to process this as a child that doesn't know if that's supposed to be a bad thing, that I'm feeling like it's him and not anybody else. Then everybody's telling you, oh, you have to be strong for your mom. You have to be strong for your mom. Strong for her? Why? I don't even care too much like that about her. So it was complex for me trying to be strong for her because everybody wants me to be strong for her, not because I really cared to be at the time. And then I had two younger ones that I felt like as an old, my younger ones were very little. My dad died. We're like, I think 2 and 3, you know. So this is the big sister and mom. And so it was very weird for me. I didn't know how to process it. I didn't cry. Mm-hmm. I didn't grieve him. I felt so many weird feelings, and I didn't know how to behave. I didn't know what to think. And it's affecting me even till today, because now I don't even know how to process emotions really. So that's why some people think I'm cold. It's not intentional. I just don't know how to process emotions really. So sometimes I can't process very extreme emotions. I don't know if I feel extreme joy sometimes or extreme anger. I don't know. So I just let things be. I'm numb. Have I still till this day mourned my dad? I don't think so. Mm. And isn't that weird? I don't think so. I don't think I've ever broken down the way I should for him. I just keep going every time saying, Dad, I want to make you proud. I want to make him proud. I want to make him feel like he never left, or I never felt his absence.
Yeah.
That's just the only thing that I hold on to, you see? So I don't know.
And so from Kaduna, I'm guessing they you came back to Lagos, right? Yes. And now we are walking through the arc of, okay, you have to be the strong one. You have to be the one who steps up for everybody. As somebody who can relate to having to be the strong one, what has your moments of, and when did you get to a point where you're like, if I don't provide self-care for myself, they'll finish me out here, right? Like where it's like, look, everything is always usually on your head. You're a decision maker. People are expecting you to always be the strong one. In what ways did you learn to show self-care to yourself where you're like, you know what? I need to rest. I need to relax. I can't carry everything on my head. And what did that look like for you?
I think it was only when I got married that I actually started to do that. When I was single with my two younger brothers, I was a mom. I've been a mom since I was 15. And there was nothing like self-care. I didn't care about myself. I had to care for these two ones. We didn't want the standard of their lifestyle or their living to go down. I promised my mom I was going to stand by her and help her. And I tried to keep to my word. So immediately I left secondary school. I started to look for a job, which is one way or the other how I found entertainment anyway. And so I was very focused on exactly what I wanted to do. I didn't have a life, pretty much. All my life was just to provide for my family, you know. And so when I met my husband, he took on that role also with me. He knew how serious that was for me. And my husband and my mother's relationship took off way more than my relationship with her. And so it was when he came into my life that I really started to understand my mom from a different point of view. And when I had my first child, then that's happened, because then I started to understand now all the things that she wanted to give to me. Now I want to give also to this child that I have had. So that was very important for me. And I got married quite early, at the age of 18, you see. Yeah. So it was a lot of growing up for me. So there was no self-care. So from taking care of my younger ones, I started taking care of my own children. So my life has been like that. So that's why, so some people, when people think I'm stuck up, or I'm not social, or you don't understand. Like, I don't even know how to.
Yeah.
All my life, I've had to take care of people. So that's the only life I know. So when I'm not taking care of people, when I'm not making decisions as the first child or as the mother, I don't know what else to do with my life, to be honest. That's the only role I know how to do. Take care of my siblings, take care of my husband, take care of my children. That's what gives me joy. That's my essence. That's all I do. And so I'm always at home. I'm a homebody. I don't go anywhere. My rest is just sit down at home and watch them all happy.
Yeah.
That's my self-care. Other than that, I go to the spa.
I love a good spa day.
I'm a spa girl. That's the only place I find some kind of peace.
Yeah.
Spa. My spa dates. I don't play with those ones.
Yeah.
That's it.
Etcher, remember that time I walked into a bank? I'm not going to give the name. And I asked them for $1,000. And they told me, no, they cannot withdraw any dollar for me. And I was so upset. And I just remember asking everybody, how can I solve this issue? And I'm so happy that I finally have V-Band to finally solve this issue for me.
You know, the thing is, you should be able to have access to your money anywhere in the world when you get paid, right? So I'm grateful we have VBAN as a sponsor of the For That Fulton podcast. With VBAN, you're able to get paid in foreign currencies, whether it's pounds, USD, euros, and you can actually spend it in local currency as well. Now, you're also able to get a virtual card, which you can use to spend in and pay for services across the world, right? So I'm grateful to have VBAN as a sponsor.
You can download it on the Apple or Google Play Store. And remember, when you sign up, you use Afropolitan so they know you came from this podcast. And I think this ties beautifully into something I write about a lot. So I write about this concept called timeline grief, which is mourning the life you thought you would have, right? And I'm curious, have you ever reflected on that? On maybe whether it's the time your father passed, maybe it's the time you got married, maybe it's the time you had your first child. Was there a moment in your life where you reflected on, I thought I was going to have this type of life, but I have this one?
I've actually seen that. But no, I feel my life is exactly the way it should be. I really do. Earlier on in my life, when I was younger, I used to feel like, oh my God, my dad was here, this one. Because I went through a lot, you know, trying to help my mom. She and I went through a lot. There were times where we were attacked in my house because they knew it was just two women or two females in the house and little kids. We've had robbers try to break into her home and it will be yelling in the middle of the night, help, help, somebody help us. You know, we've had times where we didn't have food to eat. And we had, I remember one particular time when my mom and I had to go sit down in front of a neighbor's house who was in the oil business. We waited outside his house till 1 a.m. that he came. We're just sitting outside by the gutter. We just sat down there waiting for him to come so he can, maybe we can beg him so he can give us money to buy food for the house. We've gone through things, you know. And so for me, I look at all of those things and I say they shaped me. Mm. And so those times, of course, you know, because my dad was okay when he was alive. So those times, of course, you would think, oh my God, look at my life now. Because you're going through it. You're going through it. And you think life is over, you know. And I remember, oh, there was even also a time when a colleague in the industry took me to some place. I think in Mushi, I'm not very sure where this place is till today. Some ghetto place. We walked through this rough place and God, that was really little. I was like maybe 15 or so. And we got to this place and these bad boys, you know, same things you see in Shantytown, that movie. It happened to me. They were there like in the sitting room and I begged them. I said, I was looking for money for my brother's school fees. And this guy looked at me, this little thing. They could have raped me. Like, where was I? You know, but God's grace was just with me. And they looked at me from head to toe. They said, you, can you even pay back? I said, I don't know, but I've started acting and doing modeling. I can try. Anyway, they gave me the money and then they made the person who brought me, some guy called Black, I'm sure he probably is watching, do some kind of undertaking. Anyway, I took the money. I couldn't pay back. They started coming to my house, threatening my life and all of that stuff. The guy too, they were threatening his life. They came and took the only thing that was making us happy, which was a TV, black and white TV and DVD player. They took it away. We were miserable. If there was any time I thought I was depressed, it was that period. But I say all of this to say that in that time, I thought, This has to be the worst. Like, why is life treating us this way? Like, you know, so you look at those times and you think you will never come out of it. So I hope I'm encouraging somebody today to let them know, like, there's always sunshine at the end of that. Mm-hmm. When I was going through that, I kept thinking to myself, it can't get worse than this. Like the humiliation, you know, everything, it was bad. Sometimes we didn't even know when the next meal was going to come or where it would come from. But today, you know, so now I look back and I said all of those things forged me to be who I am today. So even though I'm very comfortable today, money doesn't faze me.
Yeah.
I'm a very contented person, very, very contented, but money doesn't faze me. Money doesn't scare me. I don't worship money. I go for legacy. I go for impact. I don't care because, you know, I could lose everything today. And I would start all over again and I'll be fine. I've been there. I've been there in the bottom rack and I made it out. So I'm not scared.
Is there a survival mindset that comes with that in the sense of when you have had and it's been taken away and mm-hmm. then you get it back again, do you now move in a way where it's like, I know that I can also be taken away again, where you now start making plans for, you know, some people start developing like trusts or investments or bank accounts or making sure that I have enough to never lack again. Was that something that do you feel like at some point started to drive you? Or was it more of like, I will take things as they come because obviously God is also watching me. Like, how did you now start? Like when you regained some prosperity again or some abundance again, did you now start saying, okay, was there a sort of survival mindset that came with that because you knew what it was to have and not have.
Be in the trenches,
yeah. So what did that look like?
No, I'm not that person. Yeah. Anyone who's close to me will tell you, I'm not. I mean, don't get me wrong, I'm an overthinker. I plan. I'm that person. I plan a lot. But I plan because I feel like it's the right thing to do, not because I'm afraid. So no, I don't panic plan or panic keep or, you know, stuff like that. I just do that because I want to be prosperous anyway, but not because I'm afraid that, oh my God, I don't want to go back there or I don't. And to some extent, I think I have some kind of confidence that I can't except something really supernatural happens because I've invested a lot enough. If I don't work anymore for the rest of my life, to some extent, I could be fine. You know what I mean? If I'm not outrageously, you know, spending, I could be fine. I've put in some investments on ground. So anything I'm doing now, it's not because, oh, I am afraid that anything could go wrong. No, it's actually just because I'm alive and just not doing anything. You start to deteriorate, you know, so I'm just doing it because I can and I'm doing it because it's possible. And God has put me in a position where I can. So I will do it. So yeah, that's where I am now.
You know, another thing I want to talk about, because you kind of alluded to it, and I know a lot of women that will watch this will be encouraged. So because of just low unemployment in Nigeria, just because how difficult the economy is,
right,
I feel like a lot of women put themselves in compromising
situations.
Yeah, situations, mm-hmm. right? And as someone who could have gone there, what encouraged you not to take that way? Because you're a beautiful woman, right? You could have easily gone that way. What encouraged you to say no? Like, I have something bigger for my life.
And not to take anything away from women yeah. who have unfortunately had to go that route.
Yeah.
Because, you know, as a woman, things get thrown at you. I was on another interview recently where I talked about Nollywood and how we get gifts and stuff like that. People would give things to you. So if you're not disciplined, tendency is that you would get distracted. So for me, it was a big deal, and it was God who did it for me. I gave my life to Christ at the age of 15, right out of school. I gave my life to Christ. So that was the bedrock of my life. That was my foundation. And so when I did, I already knew what God wanted from me. My confidence came already from knowing that God got me. And somehow, truly, no matter how bad it was, there was always a way. He always made a way. So that was where my confidence came from, that, you know, he would. And I got a lot of revelations very earlier on in my life, most of which I wrote down anyway. So I heard from him, and I got the word that he got me and he would take care of me. So that was a very strong hold for me. So it helped me to not compromise. Every time it got hard and I would think, oh my God, this is it, I would remember that God already told me that he was going to get me out of it. Mm. Also, to tell you the truth, I won't say I'm a proud person, but I am very, very self-aware. Yeah. And if there's anything I hate, it is to feel like I am subservient to anyone or that I am at anyone's mercy. A lot of people have misinterpreted that to mean that I'm proud or I'm this or I'm that. It's not the truth. The truth is I'm just very confident of who I am. My confidence comes mostly from Christ, knowing who I am, and I'm a daughter of Zion, and I do not need to crawl at anyone's feet or to beg for bread. So I carry myself in that. And I've always done that. I've always carried myself with that sort of assurance and knowledge, even from a very young age. Mm. So even when and God has tested me many times, okay, that I've been put in situations where I'm telling you, I tell people, I say, if I wanted to be a billionaire, I would have been it easily. Because I have been in situations where no one would have known. Mm. And I would have taken things and compromised my stand. But I would say no and I'll walk away. Many times. And some of those people are even watching me today. Mm. And I'm talking about even sometimes in politics.
Yeah.
Many times where I could have compromised my stand or what I believe in and got paid handsomely for it. But I said no. And I walked away. Not necessarily, sometimes they're not even bad things. They're just things that would just rock your foundation or rock your belief system, you know, whatever. And, you know, so those thoughts start coming to you. It's not so bad. You know, you can explain it away. It's not like you're, you know, but in the long run, you know, it would dilute your message. And I've had to walk away. But guess what? Every time that happens and my brain tells me, oh, there you go. You've lost one big one again. Some way or the other, God always, always come through. And some of the things that I have today, money can never buy them.
Amen. You know, we had a friend of ours, Dayo Yorde, on the show, and I think he was saying how YouTube is the new platform for home videos, right?
Right.
One of the reasons I was looking forward to the conversation is you are one of the few people who've been through the VHS tape era, the cinema era, and now the streaming era, right? And you're also an insider. And I think for a lot of us, we have been consumers of the content. From your perspective, can you walk us through what those days from the VHS tapes looked like, the process, the Nollywood of then, and then to the cinemas, when the cinemas started becoming more of a thing, and now to the streaming? How have you reinvented yourself through all those different eras?
So I believe for my brand, I've been around through the VHS, like you said, that era, which was the hardest era, to be honest.
Really?
Oh, yes. Because it was manual. There was no shortcut. There was no social media. There wasn't any help or amplifying your brand quickly. you had to go through the whole process. In those days, in Nollywood, you would be known in Nollywood. I mean, there was no Nollywood. It wasn't a name at the time. It was just our industry. you'd be known in our industry in Surulere. Yeah. Then you would have to be known in Upper Weka. You'd have to be known in, like, there were zones like that. You would have to, you know, break into all those places and be known there before even fans would get to know you, before they would even put you in, because you have to be tested. Nobody's just going to put you in the movie just because. These were marketers, Igbo guys. Those guys are traders. They don't care about emotions. Can you sell my, you know? So it was hard. Like, you had to be on top of your game. And so there wasn't social media to help you amplify. You couldn't do one quick video or one quick dance and become popular, or one quick skit. People had to like you organically, and not just in Lagos. You had to be liked everywhere in Nigeria,
yeah.
You know, nationwide and stuff like that. And then before you could be exported. So we went through all of that. It was a good training, to be honest. And then we now got to the time where we have cinemas, you know, beautiful. Now it's amplified, it's big screen and stuff like that. We don't have enough screens in Nigeria. Let's be frank. Mm. Okay. So we don't have, it's not the same reach as the VHS where everybody had a DVD player. So of course it's not as big. It's a bigger screen, bigger, you know, but it's not as, the outreach, the distribution is not as big. Then now we have the streamers. The distribution is far and wide. What would I say? It's far and wide. It goes far because then in Netflix or Amazon or whatever the streaming platform is, or even YouTube, as we said,
yeah.
You can watch it from anywhere in the world.
Yeah.
So yes, all this are distribution networks that come and help us. But people still feel that the biggest era was still the VHS era. And you start to wonder why. Why do people still feel like that was the biggest era? I think it is because as time has gone on, with all the distractions, we have social media and all of this stuff, our messaging has been diluted.
Mm.
Our stories have been diluted.
Yeah.
And it's easy to get carried away with all the noise and all of that. And so for me, with my career, back to the question you asked, how I've been able to stay consistent and I stay away from the noise. I try the best I can to stay away from the noise. It's hard, but you have to switch off.
Yeah.
So I hardly listen to social media. I hardly even come on social media. When it first started, it was fun. I was the first person to have 1 million likes on Facebook. It was fun. Mm-hmm. Yay. And then it became something else. It became toxic. It became, oh my God, you're afraid. You wake up, you start having panic attacks. What have they said I did yesterday, even though I didn't leave the house? You know, some story or the other. You're like, who is it me? Who, do I have a twin? Who are they talking about? You do a movie and you're thinking, you know, there's all this, you know, things. And so it's very distracting. It waters down your thought process. And also for creatives, I don't know about other people, but for me, I just switch off. I just concentrate on what I want to do. As long as I know that my core team and my, you know, the people that I respect, that I sound things off,
yeah,
are good with what I'm doing. I'm on the right track. I just keep doing it and I keep moving. And every time that I need to go into the next place, I access it. Mm-hmm. I give it everything it needs. So I think that's the thing for me, is just knowing when to come in and knowing when to get out. Otherwise you get burnt out. 30 years, it's not easy to stay and not get burnt out.
Yeah. You know, you became one of the youngest actresses, if not the youngest actress, to win the best actress for the Mortal Inheritance, right? At 18.
I was the youngest.
Youngest, right?
Those two awards, yes.
What did that process look like for you? Because again, at 18, like you were saying, a lot of us, I think when I was 18, I was in boarding school or somewhere in that life. So you started acting very young, right? And you're winning that award. What was that process? Because that was on VHS tapes back then.
Yeah.
How was distribution back then for a film like that, to the point it gets you that nomination and then you eventually end up winning it as well? What did that process, that particular movie and film look like for you?
Yeah, that movie was amazing. People call it Omotola Inheritance, isn't it? Yes. You know, so I mean, it was also a very beautiful story about sickle cell anemia. My husband's family, they have people suffering. And so I kind of like knew what that felt like. I had a brother-in-law at the time. He's late now, Osemo Hai, who was living with sickle cell. So it was also a close story to my heart. And so when I was going to, but at the time, he wasn't my husband yet, which had just met Because by the time I finished, by the time the movie came out, I was already married and I came on stage 9 months pregnant and people were like, huh? So everything just happened very fast, yeah. Isn't it? You know, but when the whole process started, I already knew about it because I had already started dating my husband. I knew what this was about. I just did it. I did it knowing fully well that I did a lot of audition for that role and if they thought I could carry it emotionally. But when I started acting, it was even more because I was very young. And back then, we didn't have too many references. So you had to dig deep. I was all I had. Okay. So I had to dig deep and find all of that acting and all of that emotion and all of that. And you don't know how people are going to receive it. So getting to the point where I got the nominations and the distribution, like you said, was our marketers again. You know, let me use this opportunity to give them their flowers. These guys did a lot of work for Nollywood. I feel like they don't get appreciated enough. So all the wonderful marketers who pushed us in the beginning of our careers were thank you. The OJs, the Amacos, the Remy Jers. There's so many of them. Some of them are not being appreciated in this new Nollywood era because, you know, they didn't transition into this. But we want to say thank you to them for putting in so much money, time, effort. These guys were pushing this stuff, you know. And so you can imagine how much it was pushed for that movie to get those nominations. We got the nominations for Best English, Best Movie in English Speaking and the Best Movie Overall. Then I got the same nomination for those two, Best Actress in an English Speaking Movie and Best Actress Overall. And I won both of them. And I was against the biggest in the industry. I saw it recently in the paper and I celebrating my 30 years and all of that. And I was just in shock. The biggest in the industry, Liz Benson, Rachel Oniga, you know, I think I saw Taiwo Ajayi-Laiset also in one of, I was like, what? I mean, these are people that I admire, that I love and everything. It's just been a great journey. Yeah, I was on top of the moon. Yes.
What did your mom feel about you winning?
When I won that?
Yeah.
I don't think at the time she wasn't excited at the time. It was early days. Like I said, I just got married. She actually thought this was going to even end my marriage, to be honest. I remember her saying something of that nature.
With the award?
No, the acting.
Acting, yeah.
She didn't want me acting at all. She used to beat me a lot then. And I remember another person I need to give his flowers, Zebi Giro, the Sheikh. He was like a godfather to me at the time. And they went to see my mom to beg her, to tell her to please let me act. And so she said, you have to promise me that you'll watch over her. So the Sheikh actually was like the guarantor to let me act, you know, Zebi Giro. And so that's why she even let go a little bit. So when I was getting married, she told my husband, this is what she's doing. I don't know why she's doing this. At the time, I was already in school doing estate management. And she was like, I don't know why she would not focus on her studies and why she's going into this. I just wanted to know, I don't approve and all of that. And she would tell me, this thing you're doing is going to end your marriage because people are going to keep seeing you like you're a prostitute or you're a loose person. And I just said to her, I said, I will make you proud. Just leave it alone.
Yeah.
And God bless my husband. Amazing, amazing man. My husband was like, don't worry. It's okay. Let her be. Let her do what she wants to do. So she had to let go. Because now I'm no more her priority. Her charge. Yeah, she's no more in charge. I'm not like directly under her anymore. I'm now married. And so when I won those awards, I guess I can't remember, to be honest. I can't remember her reaction, but I don't remember her being excited either. I think she was just like, yeah, we'll see. Hopefully not. That just ruins your, you know, a good thing that you have going on. But yeah, but I know that before she died, long after all of that, I remember her saying to me, ah, thank God you continued, you know. Yeah. I remember her saying that, like,
I don't know if you know, but dating scene these days, It's crazy out here.
I know, I have adults. My last child is 24.
Okay, so they're telling you what they're seeing out here. When you reflect back on it, because my parents too also got married young, right? Do you feel like there was a trade-off we've made as a society where things compound? So if you're going married at 18, you know, I'm sure by a certain age, you already became an empty nester. They already left the house.
Right.
But it also allows you when you're 18 or when you're younger to make a decision where if you've made the right decision, it compounds beautifully, right? Whereas I think in our generation now, we are inundated by so many options, quote unquote, which is really illusions, right? Mm-hmm. But it's made a lot of people stuck in being knowing how to commit to something, right? What would you say gave you the confidence to commit at such a young age and say, okay, this is what I'm going to commit the rest of my life to? Because that really is what a marriage vow is, right?
It is.
So what gave you that confidence to say, this is who I'm going to commit to? And obviously it's compounded. It's 30. Also, you're celebrating 30 years in Nollywood. You're also celebrating 30 year anniversary too.
Yes.
Right? So
marriage anniversary. Yes.
Beautiful. And it's compounded. So what would you say gave you the confidence to commit like that?
The right person. I've always been a very decisive person from when I was a child. I know what I want. I knew what I wanted. So when I met him and I saw his antecedents, I saw how serious he was. I saw that he was a career-minded person. We had our goals aligned. We had the rights and religion, you know. So he was also a born-again Christian. I was young and he inspired me. He had been born again for a few years prior to me. So we were doing Bible studies together. He was always encouraging me. So I looked up to him. And I knew at the time that was something very important for me because I'm a rebel, you see. My brain is the way my brain works. If I can't respect you or look up to you, my brain starts to tell me, you don't need this person. This person is not adding anything to your life. My brain starts to wander away. But I think one of the biggest things that I got from that meeting him the first time was, this is a guy that would teach me a lot. So I was excited. It excited me. And it didn't hurt that he wasn't always around too. He was a pilot. He was not even flying in Nigeria. So I looked forward to always seeing him and learning from him. So our relationship was very platonic. It was very inspiring. It was always, because he was always flying around the world. So, and I was a very inquisitive person. So like he used to always say to me like, okay, when we see, can we do like 50 to 60% of talking and then 40 to 30% of loving? Yeah. I'm talking about love things because I would never talk about lovey-dovey things. Yeah. I wasn't just interested. I was just always like that child who just wanted to know like, okay, so what happened in Barbados when you went to Barbados? Yeah. Like, who are their celebrities? You know, I was very inquisitive. I hadn't traveled much, you know, and I wanted to know how things were done in other climes and stuff like that. But he never got tired. Mm. And that's how I knew this was my person. He would oblige me. Everything I wanted, it was done. Mm-hmm. And he inspired me, you know. So it was a no-brainer. I just knew that this is someone that for the rest of my life, and he respected me. Respect is a big deal for me, even till this day. So from the onset, I knew that this person respects my soul, respects my brain and where I'm going, defends it. What else do I need? You know, so I knew that I could live with this person for the rest of my life and be comfortable.
Mm.
Yeah.
You've said once that divorce is not an option, right? Mm-hmm. And with how just crazy the entertainment industry has been, how have you been able to fortify your marriage in such a way that no one can come and penetrate it?
Divorce is not an option for me. It doesn't mean it's not an option for you. Let's get that straight.
Yes, yes.
I'm not against divorce. Mm-hmm. I just always believe that marriage is a very personal thing. My marriage can never be the same thing as your marriage. No two marriages are the same because no two persons are the same. So the ingredients might not be the same. You might not be married to the kind of person I'm married to. My husband is a very selfless person, has no ego. I've been married to him now 30 years. I've never fought over a girl. You know, so I don't have those kind of problems. He doesn't disturb me. If I have to go do my work, I go do my work. I come back. He trusts me totally. I trust him. So indices might not be the same with yours. You might be dealing with someone that has broken your trust and you're trying to build that back, you know. So those things are different, if you know what I'm trying to say. So for me, how do you want to penetrate? It's going to be very hard because I know this person. I've been with this person for 30 years since I was 18. He was 28. No, I've actually known him since I was 16 because I dated him for 2 years. So I've known him all my life. I know all his good habits. I know all his bad habits. I know he's like my brother though at this point. I almost don't know what he would do right now that would make me dislike him to the point of hate. Mm. Even if I decide to walk away from this relationship tomorrow, which I think will never happen. But even if that ever happens, I mean, he does something that I can't take and it just shatters me. And I decide, you know what? This is where I draw the line and I walk away. there'll be a problem because the next woman or wife or anybody or girlfriend would have to still deal with me. I'm still going to be in his life.
Yeah.
I don't know if anybody can process that, but I am too close to him to just go. And he can't get rid of me either. So you're going to be at a disadvantage. Don't come. There's no point. There's no point because we've gone too far, you know. And so, but if for other people though, if you feel like your life has been threatened, your peace, your mental state and all of that stuff, and you try everything, you've tried, therapy, you've tried everything, you've tried family, you've tried everything, you've separated. I always believe people should separate first. You've stayed away for a while. It's not getting better. And you decide you want to divorce. That's okay too. It's okay too.
In 2005, the Nollywood G8s, they tried to ban you and other top actors from the industry, right? Mm-hmm. Most actors reconciled quickly. You refused for 2 years. What was that process like? And you know, now when we say 2008, it's really, we mean like what, almost 20 years ago now, which is crazy. Right? Is, but what was that process like? And what was the beef? What was the beef over?
Yeah, we were pushing for standards in the industry. Yeah. Myself and some other great thespians in the industry just decided we want to push this industry forward. And we kept encouraging each other. Like, I would do something, you would hear about it. Like, okay, you would top that. And so we were pushing the industry forward. And I believe at the time, our ogas, you know, our distributors at the time, the marketers, they didn't just like that. Because they understand pennies and cobbles here. So they're counting that, you know. So for you coming in and then asking for, and don't forget that the way they started this industry was we're selling cassettes. Now we can put a motala on top of cassettes and sell it instead of ₦2 that you're selling cassette. Now you can sell it for ₦4. So you see, they've done their calculation. It's okay. That's just his market. They don't care about your feelings. Nobody, you know, that was not part of the deal. Just put your face on this thing and do whatever you want to do. Let me sell it, you know. And then we came in and we're like, no, the standards, you know, this is how it's supposed to be done. Like, what is that? So they were like, they're not having it.
But what type of standards though? Like, what are we talking about here?
I mean, like in those days, for example, you could come on set and even till now, I hear sometimes you could come on set and just walk on end. There's no...
Because walk on end. Oh, work
no
without
time,
pause.
Yeah, there's no time break. There's no breaks. There's no closing time.
No trailers.
Trailers. The first time I ever had a trailer was when I was doing the SAG movie. Really? Yeah, in Ghana. Ties that bind with Kimberly Ellis, who was a SAG actor. So that was in her rider.
Yeah.
And then they also put in the rider that her co-stars must have their own trailer so we don't disturb her. And that was the first time I had my own trailer, at least in Africa.
Really?
Yes.
I mean, so where do you guys, what do you guys do? What do you guys
do?
We
stay in backrooms.
Back room or something. Or we're shooting in people's houses. We're sitting in their living rooms, in their bedrooms, whatever. Any place you find.
Wow.
Yeah. You know, so we're just changing all this. We're gradually changing all these things. And then maybe times when they will bring, we call it welfare, which is food. You know, sometimes you'll be working and you want to take a break to go eat. But yeah, please now, you know, we have to leave this house. You know, I mean, sometimes it's not their fault. You know, sometimes we're under like very tight conditions. Maybe they've only given us an hour to use this mansion and we have to get all these 20 things done. You know, and you're the one who's going to lose for that because you can't rest. You know, and everything. So we were pushing for standards. Like, you can't do that. People need to rest. You can't bring a child on set and there's no minder. You can't. So, and we were using ourselves as the shield, the body shield. Because if I don't work and I say, until you get this right, I'm not going to come on set. Everything stops till you get that right.
Yeah.
So we're the body shield for that. Yeah. We're the ones.
Pioneers, basically.
Sorry?
Pioneers.
Or yeah, enforcers. Not even just pioneers. We're actually sacrificing. We're sacrificing ourselves, our careers, you know, to help bring the industry to some kind of standard and stuff like that. So, of course, we're targets. And they weren't having it. It just felt like we were wielding way too much power and that we were disrupting things for them. And so I heard, you know, they decided there was just two of us that were the real problems. And then decided, we just put all of them, all the other ones too, and add them to the list. And then so we became 8, I think, that did added to the list. And so after 1 year, they called everybody back for a meeting. I don't remember where. I think in Onitsha or somewhere.
And you didn't go?
No. Sorry, Rebel. I was like, okay. No. And so they extended my ban to 2 years.
Whoa. It's funny because, you know, obviously ever since then technology has changed and the leverage has gone even now more to the person who's creating the content. Like someone like you now has much more leverage than they do, right? And I wonder if moments like that show how you as a person who's in any industry, you really should be, you should work for win-win situations, right? Because now when the winds have changed,
right,
a lot of people basically just left them on the side and said, guy, peace out, because peace out. Your job your job was really more of a middleman anyway. And you wasn't really that great of a middleman job anyway. So I wonder if that's something that, you know, they reflect on. But obviously, you've also gone on to do other movies as well. I want you to help break down to our audience the business of filmmaking, right? Because you've been the actor or actress in the movie, and you've also now been the director of the movie. What are the differences between shooting in places like the US versus shooting in Nollywood? And obviously, you spend time now between LA and Lagos, right? So what are some of the differences and standards that you see that you're like, okay, these are some of the things we can use here, and what are the things that we have here that you're like, when you're over there, you're like, wow, I wish they know how we're doing it over here as well?
Yeah, thank you for that question. Haven't done about 2 or 3 projects now in the US. No, not the US, let's be precise, in Hollywood, because the US sometimes it's we're shooting some movies and they're still almost like Nollywood style. But I'm talking about Hollywood, yeah. Like mainstream. I think so. Let me start with the things that I feel like they could learn from us, which is some sort of the same things I talked about earlier. The fact that we just don't stop. I think that's something that Tyler Perry now is trying to do with the style of shoots. We don't waste money in Nollywood as much. We are very good. We're very prudent because really you're spending your own money. You don't have time. You can't afford to waste any kind of money. So we're shooting back to back. Yeah, excessively sometimes it has its downsides where people are fatigued, people maybe have accidents because we're not doing things thoroughly and stuff like that. But the upside or the good side to that also is that we don't waste money and we don't waste time. Compared to Hollywood where, you know, I mean, when I shot, for example, let's use EJ, there's a movie that was the first one we shot there. It was coming to Christmas, we were very frustrated because every time we would shoot, after like a few hours, the crew would be like, they want to go take a smoke break. We'd be like, Jesus Christ, please help us keep our mouths. Because we're like, what? And then just when they come back and we're getting into the groove of things and you hear, oh, we need to go take a coffee break. What? Again? You know, because we weren't used to that. We're like, again, you're going to take coffee break after the smoke break? And then just when you're getting into the groove, they're like, oh, so we have to finish shoots, you know, because we can't go past, you know, how many hours of shoot. And they're very strict because, you know, the guilds are very strict. And you're like, oh, God, at this point, we're going to do Christmas in LA. We're not going to be able to make it back home. So maybe I'll say, maybe they can reduce some of these breaks. You know, I think that's something that Nollywood does well. We have to find the balance, you know, between taking breaks and taking excessive breaks. That's something we do well here. The fact that we don't complain as much. Oh, they complain a lot, you know. Mm. Yeah. And it's also good because it's standards to some extent, but I just feel like sometimes it'd be much because if something just wasn't right a little bit, you know, they could down tools for that and stuff. But here we make do. We make do. We're like, you know, we make do. If something is not quite there, we would be, okay, what's the next alternative? How do we make this work? You know, and everybody puts their back into it. Nobody goes, oh, that's your job. It's not my job. You know, figure it out. You know, we all try to make it work. You know, it's neither here or there too, because then that could also be a bad thing. Because yeah. It could be like, okay, mind your business. Maybe the reason why we don't do things well also is because everybody jumps into it and tries to solve the problem. So it's, yeah, we just have to find the right balance, you know. Now, the things that we could learn from them, other than standards and doing things properly pre-production, which I'm guilty of also from my own movie, you know, by circumstance, but pre-production. And then something that I talk about all the time, putting money in escrow. Like, why is that so hard for us? Like, you hear people say, oh, you know, they got money from BOI or some kind of body or stuff like that. And before the project starts, the producer, according to them, would have spent the money on this and that. And it's heartbreaking when international bodies actually are involved. Because I'm like, what are you teaching us? You know how it's done internationally. You know that these monies should not go to the producer. Why are you trying to tempt them? Mm. It's not fair. Like, it's, I can blame the producer, but I really should blame you more, because you have standards. You should come into this environment and teach those standards and make sure that people understand the standards, keep to those standards, because that's how you leave the local community better off. Not come and conform to their standards and leave them worse off. Yeah. And then go back and say, oh, you know, they're not disciplined. They did this or they did that. But you let that happen. Yeah. Cause you know better. Cause you know that even if you did that with Americans, they will spend your money too.
Yeah.
Excuse me. Why are you making it look like it's just Nigerians that can do that? The Americans who have. Look, I've only been duped in America. I've never been duped in Nigeria.
Really?
Yeah. In the 5 years that I've stayed there. And I'm not talking about thieves. I'm talking about organized
duping
bodies. Yes. So, and it's done legally. It's in the fine print. So my point is this. Anybody can misuse opportunities, monies and stuff like that. But there are things done to mitigate these things.
Yeah.
There are standards. There are procedures. So I believe that if Nigerians and or Nollywood were to be strict to follow those standards or those procedures, then we would not have as many issues that we've had in the past.
Would you say that that's the same issue that happened with like the Netflixes and the Amazons of the world? Because from your perspective, because you're also an insider, could you give us your perspective on these international streaming services have come into the country? There's a lot of hype around it. And then after a couple of years, they leave. What do you think they got right? And what did they get wrong? And if you were in charge tomorrow of any policy or anybody, what would you change to help them build more sustainable practices that enable a thriving ecosystem?
Yes. So it's been said that this that we just talked about was part of the problem. We also heard that subscriber rates were not as high. So that could also be the problem. Knowing fully well that in Nigeria, we all can share. We love to share. We are family oriented. You know, so that might be also part of that problem. But whatever the problem is, we have the numbers. I feel like sometimes it's just discipline and staying the course, understanding the people, and also enlightening people. I feel like people here are not quite sometimes enlightened on how things are done globally. When you're in Nigeria, it's almost like you're in a silo. I'm not even kidding. Like when I was, before I relocated, everything just seemed to be over and around my life here. And it's not the same when you visit, it's different. But when I relocated and I really sat down there, I had to unlearn a lot of things. Unlearn a lot of things.
Like what?
Oh, so many things. For example, I'll start from the most silly thing, like even just checking your DMs. Yeah, you're a star. Why are you checking your DMs? You know what I mean? Like, but there, everybody communicates with you through DMs. Mm-hmm. Time management. Mm-hmm. Just being humble, not as a human being, but even it, with the job, like with our work, just be humble, because really, you feel like a star. Like, I've arrived at everything. And then you get there, you're like, damn, I haven't done much, have I? You know, it's just, and it's not even in the numbers, it's in the quality of work. It's in the things that you've done here that everybody has praised you for. And then you're now comparing with other people from other parts of the world, and you're realizing, oh my God, we still have a long way to go. It's in little things like being on set and we're not even knowing that as crew, you shouldn't be wearing open toe sneakers or slippers, or, you know, just little standards, things like that. Also go all the way to royalties, you know, the fact that I've only worked how many jobs in LA right now, and I just came back from LA yesterday and my envelopes like that, a pile of residuals waiting for me. I couldn't even open it because I was only in LA for 3 days and I had to rush back. So I couldn't even open those envelopes. They'll be there waiting for me when I get back. But I've only put in 5 years in LA, in Hollywood. I put in 30 years here. I've never received an envelope.
No. My post doesn't know your address.
That post has lost your address.
Yeah. They don't have my address. They don't know where I live or if I was to leave. It's not happening. And no one has also thought, oh my God, you know, this movie did so well. I'm just going to send you a check.
Yeah. Just thank you. Gratitude.
Yeah, we smile and go. Our film did well. Yeah, yeah, I did well. Yeah.
Wait, when did you know you had to relocate?
No, it wasn't like a decision I made at some point. Just go, oh, I have to relocate. No, it just happened. And I've had opportunities to relocate in time past, to be honest. From 2013, when I got Time 100, a lot of things just opened to me. Oh, was it then or before? Oh, no. It was 2010, after I did my second album. That was the first time I was going to relocate. And I got signed to Universal Studios, Bangalore Universal. I had an opportunity to relocate and be a part of a band. And I turned that down at the time. The other time was 2013 when I got Time 100. I got an opportunity to relocate. I even did this very famous interview at the time with CNN, on CNN, sorry. And I said, oh no, I will not be relocating out of Nigeria. I'm going to be like Bob Marley and everything is just going to happen from here because why not? And I believed it. Yeah. I still do.
2013 was a golden year though. That was still good luck now.
That was, yeah.
Nigeria was still, you know,
your money compared was, to now. Things were flowing.
Yeah.
It wasn't that. It wasn't about that.
No, I know, but the country was better, is what I'm saying.
For people that it was better for, I mean, I don't know, but I've never done anything with government. Yeah. So I don't, that was never my issue.
Yeah.
It was just the fact that there was no major reason to relocate at the time. Plus, my husband has always said he doesn't really want to relocate. So I'll be there by myself. Even though my kids were there, I just felt like that could even break up my family. Anyway, so COVID happened. Fast forward to COVID happening. I have another opportunity to relocate. And this time around, I just said, you know, people died. Life as we've known it has changed. I've always wondered what it would be like if I even ever tried. I didn't want to because I felt like, you know, the balance would change. You would, at the point which I am in my life, I would have to start some things all over again. It's quite scary. It's daunting. And I didn't really want to do that, to be honest. If I wanted to be honest with myself, I wanted to stay in my comfort zone. But after COVID and all of that happened, I just said, you know what? YOLO. I'll just take the dive because I don't want to ever look back and regret that this opportunity came at least three times in my life. There's a reason why it keeps coming back. Some people never even get this opportunity once. This has come back three times. And I asked my husband and he was like, yeah, if you want to leave, that's fine. Let's do it. So all the indices that before never came together just came together. And I just knew it was the right time. It's one of the best decisions I've ever taken.
What did it feel like?
Yeah. I want to know what has changed.
Everything is how calm I am now. It's my mentals. I come back to Nigeria, Lagos, and it almost seems like I didn't grow up here. It's just the way, it's just my mind. My mind has changed a lot with the way even I comport myself. Life is like, Nigeria is hectic. Lagos particularly is very hectic. There's so many things. It's the parties, it's the going to this, it's the invites, it's the, you're constantly thinking of, you know, like impressing this person. In Cali, nobody cares. Like if there's a movie premiere, whatever, you can wear whatever you want. As long as you look neat, you're fine. It's just, that's also part of the things I unlearned, you know, that feeling of, oh, I have to book a makeup artist. I have to book a hairstylist. I have to book a stylist. I have to take pictures before I go out. I have to post it quickly before this horrible photographers go and post a picture of my belly, you know, protruding or something. I have to post my own pictures and all that pressure that we put on ourselves. Oh my God, what are the blogs saying? It's not like these things don't happen to you there, but I think it's quite intense here. Mm. It's very intense here that you are in a cocoon. You're just in that, it's a pressure cooker. You're in there. You're like, it's a lot. It's a lot. Every time I go back to LA, even just this 3 days I went, I could breathe. There's no, and maybe it's because I'm not yet on Angelina Jolie's level yet, or I don't know. Maybe because I'm not yet walking the streets and everybody's like, oh my God, it's you, Matala. Maybe. But at least for me, at this point in my life, that's where I find my peace. I can breathe. I can walk around. Even though people recognize me here and there, it's still calm. So that's where I am now in my life. That's a big deal for me. I need it. After working in the industry since I was 15, I kind of like need it. I deserve it. I deserve some kind of peace.
But did it take a while for you to acclimate in a sense of, like you said, you've gone from being a queen of your own area, and then you're going over here and you have to basically now learn new things, and it's almost like learning new wills, right? Because a lot of times some people can't handle that, where you're like, look, I know what it feels like to be the Angelina Jolie of my side.
Yes.
And even the attention I was getting is nothing compared to what you guys are doing here. Yes. Right. So what did that look like? And from you talking to your ego, like, what did it look like to now have a conversation like, okay, humility, be humble. And maybe you've always been humble, but what does that look like? Because even no matter what we say as humans, it always does.
It creeps in,
right? Yeah. So what did that look like for you?
Remember I said that earlier when I said I had to unlearn and be humble. And there are times, I'll give you a very quick example. I was working behind the scenes on a very big project. And I remember the lady who was the supervisor of that project, she's our cousins, African-American. And so I called her. I'm that person who always wants a project to be better, right? So I called the psych because we're doing some voice, and then she doesn't quite know Africa, and the voice was the sounds. So it was an Igbo lady, and the movie we're doing is not from that region, but they have people from Egun, you know, and Yoruba. And so the Igbo lady was also doing her voice. So I was trying to tell the African American, I know you don't know, but that's language is not from that region. So maybe she would do more of pidgin. She should do more of pidgin and not speak Igbo, because it's not that region. And she said, oh, thank you very much, but you know what, the studio don't care. I was like, you don't care that you get our language right and get it right for us? No, don't care. And that thing really upset me. It really upset me, and I started to feel the activist in me rising.
Rebellion.
I was like, what? You don't care? And then somebody told me, oh, I'm a taller. Okay. This is not Nigeria. We are just coming here newly. We are not going to fight. And we're not going to be activists right now. And you know, it took everything in me, everything I could muster, to walk away from this lady and not crush her. Because I knew so many things I wanted to say to her. Like, how dare you? How dare you be walking on something that's to do with my culture and say you don't care? My culture is paying your bills right now. And you look me in the eye and say you don't care if you get it right. Would you say that if it was, you know, an European project? Would you say that if it was even an Asian project? These days, you guys want to get it right for them. You know, it took everything. That would never happen if it was Nollywood, you know. But these are the things that you have to learn. You have to learn the differences. You have to learn to buy time. It's just a matter of time. One day she will see me again. I would not know her clearly, but she would remember me. And then she would remember that happened. And I would, by God's grace, be a part of the people who will correct that, I hope.
So
those are the things that, you know, sometimes happen to you when you're not in your comfort zone that test you. But you have to remember what your bigger goal is, and then you have to swallow it. Take it. But keep the vision on. Keep your eyes on the goal and go, this would only energize me to fight harder. Yeah, that's my motivation.
I love that. And I now want to talk about your movie that's coming out, right?
Yeah.
And by the time this video comes out, it'll probably be like 1-2, this video, and then it'll come out. So I'm curious what inspired it. And you relocating, did it help you really understand how to go into this movie production, like take it to the next level? Because it showed at TIFF, right? And so I'm curious about, do those connections help you there?
Absolutely. If I hadn't relocated, I would not be thinking of showing this movie at festivals. I'll be too afraid. Because mothers love this project as much as I love it right now, and a lot of people are loving it. I didn't feel that way when I just shot this project, because I didn't shoot it intentionally. I was only here on vacation, and one thing led to the other, and I shot this project. And so I was very afraid, because I felt I didn't do enough of the pre-production to shoot this project. And I know that that's the most important part of any production.
What is pre-production to, just for our people?
Is it the
time when you plan the production. That's like 70% of the work.
Really?
Yes. Shooting on set is as a result of what you have done with the planning. The post-production too is as majorly a result of what you have done with the planning. If your planning is, if your pre-production is great, all of this, they come with their own challenges as well. Don't get me wrong, but then you would have done most of the work. Especially for filmmaking, it's, that's the major, that's the big part. If your pre-production is not tight, you will be in serious trouble on set and even in post.
Can you give us an example? Because I'm really curious. Like pre-production, I want to do a movie. So you're thinking about the actors, the set. Like,
those are the easy parts.
Yeah.
You have to think of your distribution from ahead. Yeah.
Oh.
Where is this going to land? Where's the home for it? That's part of your pre-production.
Yeah.
Where is the money to even shoot this production? Is that, like the Bible says, he who wants to build a house, you must first know that you already have some provision, right? And on how you're going to finish it. So imagine you have not planned enough, knowing fully well that when you start productions, things happen. There's going to be a lot of, you know, things that you never planned for. So miscellaneous, you know, you have to have that kind of money. You also have to think about, okay, where is this going to land? Is it going for the Oscars? Because you have to shoot separately for the Oscars. You don't shoot movies the way you shoot if you're taking it to Netflix. And I think that's another thing that we haven't talked about enough. Mm-hmm. Projects that you're taking to different kind of distributions, it would matter from the scripting. There's a way you write for streaming networks because they have time. They can pause, go, come back. So it's a little bit more of a slow burn. They want to savor it. They want to enjoy. They want to enjoy the process. They want to talk about it. They want, you know, so the writing is different. The shooting style is different. There's a way you write and shoot for cinema. It's different. There's a way you write and shoot for the Oscars. It's different. And the same thing for festivals is different. So we sometimes on this side of town don't know, understand that. So we just do a project. We want to put in all this. It's not a one size fits all. It doesn't work. So when you're going into a project, you already know where your main target is. Doesn't mean that you won't explore other medium and platforms, but you already know that this is my main target and you shoot for that target. Mm-hmm. You might get it. You might not get it, but that's what you're aiming for. Okay. So that's mostly your pre-production. And of course, then you now talk about what you would need on set, but that's mostly it. You have to wait from that, planning. You already know how everything else is going to fall in line. And then you have to also decide who's the producer, who's, you know, all these things is detailed, very, very detailed. Your recce, you have to know what the locations are. You should have gone ahead of time. You should have done your mood board, you know, so when you get on set, you know the shots exactly you're taking. You don't come and waste everybody's time. So shoot from this angle. Let's shoot from this angle. You know what? No, you already have your shots planned. You know, when I come in here, I just want a close up shot. I don't even need masters. I don't need any master shots here because I'm not going to use it. When I come into this shot, I just want this person to walk this way. I just want to see their back. So for that reason, I don't need to be shooting them walking into the, because I'm not going to use that. You already know what you want. You already know the shots and what it's going to look like by the time you're done. The color, what about your color palettes? You already know, you know, all of these things are all pre-production.
Mm.
Yeah. So I knew that I didn't have enough of that for the movie because everything happened so fast. I was very nervous. So me finishing this movie and going into, because I already decided that, you know what, worst case scenario is just me and my family who are going to watch this film. At least I started. At least, you know, I can say I put my feet in water and I started the process. That was, to be honest, that was, because I was so scared. I was like, no, I'm not going to do anything to jeopardize my name. So at least I know that I used that time right. Because I already did a little YouTube project. And so I was already in the groove. You see, I was feeling like, oh, let's just shoot it. But I went to LA and then they started editing it and they were like, this is good, Omotola. It's good. You can actually let people see this project. I was like, really? And so I went to USC. I'm sure you know USC.
Yes.
That's a very tough place film. To show your film.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I went there and I showed the film and I knew that, look at this, a film. This is like the biggest film.
Yeah, this is where Ryan Coogler went. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Exactly. That's where Ryan Coogler, that's the best place to test your film. So I knew that if this film was bad,
they will let
the first.
You know right there.
they'll cut it.
They will cut your throat. So that was the first place I showed the movie at USC. So from the feedback I got, and professors were in the room and they were all like, wow, this is impressive. For your debut, for any kind of movie, this is impressive. I think that was the first time I had confidence.
Yeah.
And then God helped me and started bringing this. I call this movie a gift. I didn't even know that I needed this movie. this movie has been a blessing to me, and I believe it will be a blessing to so many people. I just came from watching this movie right now to this, and I know all the parts that were taught because of this movie. So I'm gifted with this movie. This movie chose me, and I believe that it would be a blessing to a lot of families as well.
Yeah. You know, you nearly died also with shooting this movie, right? You had some health challenges.
Oh my God, you guys remember that?
Oh no, I mean, we do our research. You know, and for our listeners, again, the name of the movie is called Mother's Love.
Mother's Love.
And when you went through the health challenge, right? And I think for a lot of people who are suffering through health challenges, and you have that realization like, man, my mortality is facing me for real, right? What happened? It says that you were sleeping like only 2 hours a day, right? And you know, you found out some of the health challenges. What did it feel like? And you know, during that process, when you're really sick, you start asking God, like, please, if you can just get me out of this, I promise you.
I will change. I'll sleep more. I'll eat better.
I'll do better. Yeah. So what was that process like for you, and how did it feel? And was it scary?
It was so scary. I'm not that person who has health issues. In fact, when I was having babies, they used to call me Hebrew, like Hebrew. They used to call me Hebrew, but that's H square.
Yeah.
Like Hebrew. You are not just Hebrew, you are Hebrew. Like I would go in to go have my babies, and then I'll just pop out the baby. And because I was always very skinny at the time, till I had even my last child, I was very skinny. I'll pop out the baby. People didn't even know I was pregnant most times. When I shot Samadura, the movie, I was 9 months pregnant.
Wow.
Yeah. When I shot Samadura, which other movie was that? I was 9 months pregnant. So even some of my colleagues wouldn't know I was pregnant when I'm 9 months pregnant, okay? And I'll pop out the baby and then I'll be on set maybe the next day. Yeah, I would just walk out of the hospital and they were like, no, just stay one night. I'm like, nah, I have work. And I'm gone. So I'm that person. So I don't know. I said to take it for granted maybe. But when I was editing this movie, I was barely sleeping. We were doing back to back because I kept trying to release it, not this year, last year, and all of that. And this pain from nowhere just kept haunting me. And I kept thinking, because the first thing that started was acid reflux.
Yes.
So I thought that was it, you know, because it was hurting me to my back. So I said, oh my God, it has to be this acid reflux again back. But they would rush me to ER and then they would, you know, they would send me back home after giving me a drip or something like that. Anyway, the last time this happened, I had been working with the editor back to back, and my kids wanted to go see, you know, I'm part of the voting member of the academy. Yeah. And so they wanted to go see Gladiator at the time. And I have to be there for them to be able to be there. So I had to accompany them. They were there. They wanted to talk to Denzel. So I just sat down there waiting for them to finish the movie so they could go talk to him and all of that. And I couldn't watch this movie while the whole thing was on. I was in pain. But because of my kids, I wanted to just wait so they could talk to him. But before the movie was over, I was literally rolling on the floor. It was ridiculous. So they couldn't even talk to him. When they started opened up for the question and answers and everything, I was like, I have to go now. They took me from there straight to ER. Like, I could not even stand. They had to use stretcher or whatever to take me into the into the hospital. That was the last one. And then they started doing the CT scan, doing all the scans, and they were like straight to surgery. Oh yeah. They immediately started preparing me for surgery. Everything just happened so fast. I was like, what is going on? So immediately started calling my husband. My husband was in France or something. They started calling him like, we need consent. It was intense. I was like, what is going on? Like, am I dying? They're like, how did you, like, it was so inflated, my gallbladder. I think it was about to explode or something. It was horrible. And I had high BP. It was a lot. And in all of this, I was just thinking, oh dear, what have I done to myself? Anyway, I did the surgery, finished, and then you would think I would have learned my lesson. Right there on the bed, I was calling the editor to not take another job. I was like, I'm coming, please. Like, I'm coming begging back. You, because this is a Hollywood editor. Okay, I'm like, please, I've done the surgery, I'm fine, I'm alive. I'm coming back to the studio. The guy was like, don't call me, get well, what's wrong with you? Are you okay? Why are you calling me at this time? Yeah, but that was that story last year. It's a new feeling for me. It was like a baby. I enjoyed the process, tough even till now, but it's new. I stayed this long to do this project, and I just wanted to enjoy the ride.
Sorry, I just want to have one last question. Mm-hmm. You're 48, 30 years in film,
30 Years Married, over 300 movies, Time 100, Oscar voted, UN Ambassador, directorial debut at TIFF, 4 children, emergency surgery, you survived. When you look at all of that, right? Which Omotoa are you proudest of?
Am I proudest of?
Yeah.
Which one? Which version of
which
you?
Version
damn.
Of you?
What? I didn't expect that kind of a question. What Omotoa am I proudest of? No, I can't. All of them. I can't pick one. And I know that emotionally or sentimentally, people want me to say, oh, that I'm a mother.
I was going to say that. I was like, I'm a mother. Yeah.
I am very proud to be a mother of beautiful, beautiful children. 4 of them that give me so much joy by God's grace. Don't give me any stress. They're doing very well.
Amen.
But I'm also very proud of all my achievements. I really am. From that little girl who lost her father when I was 12, mm-hmm. who was living in Yanopaja, I'll tell you something funny. There was a time when one of those days where I felt very down. I had not even met my husband at the time. All my friends, you know, started traveling out. Everybody left. I was alone. My best friends, like 4 of my best friends, all left to the UK or to America. I was alone. I felt like life had left me, like, you know, I felt alone. And I remember one day I was crying so hard, and I remember looking at God and I said, God, do you hate me? Then I went to my father's drawer and I took his international passport and I looked at it and I said, maybe if I went to the embassy and I showed them his passport and they saw how much he traveled, maybe they would give me a visa.
Wow.
Yeah. So to come from that girl at that age of what, 12 or 13 or something, no, this was 15, because I had left secondary school, who wanted to go beg them at the embassy, like, look at my dad's passport. He was always traveling. So please give me a visa. I need to leave too. I'm depressed or something. To someone who's now leaving. I wasn't born in America. Who's now leaving in America. Not just my alone, but I can stay there with my family. How can I pick just one thing?
Yeah.
How? For that girl who used to go sit down in front of somebody's house with her mother to beg for food. To someone today who, I have properties around the world. How did I get here? How could I just be proud of only one thing? God has been too good to me. Mm. I'm very grateful. Mm. I'm very grateful.
Mm.
I couldn't pick one thing. I'd be too ungrateful to pick just one thing. Yeah.
I think I want to, before we get into a rapid fire, because you said something, and I say this all the time. How do we get old Nollywood back? I want, like I still think of like BlackBerry Babes, like there's so many movies that like we had, because we have interesting stories. We have, and there was a, and it doesn't matter how people say, oh, it was crappy or the quality was bad. Like, I don't care. Like the stories were intriguing. It was part 1, part 2, part 3, part 4. Like they were so, you know, and I feel like now, like you said, is diluted. Like you said, like how do we get back there? Or I don't know.
Start by watching Mother's Love. No, I kid you not. Start by watching Mother's Love, and we're coming back. And it's so intriguing because I didn't know how much people really were stuck in that, you know, on that era. I didn't know until I started meeting so many people going, oh, I don't watch movies anymore. I stopped watching when you guys stopped acting so much. The last movie I saw of you was Lockdown, which was the last film I did, and maybe 1 or 2 of other people's films, and that's it. I don't even watch. And I'm like, really? People don't, but I guess they have their own new audience as well. But a lot of people who have seen, and even a lot of you, it's so weird. Even a lot of the young ones, the Gen Zs, you think, oh, they'll be like, oh yeah, I don't really know much about your era. I know this era. But it's so funny. Like if the Gen Zs are the ones even saying that, oh my God, I watch only old Nollywood movies on YouTube. And I'm like, what? So I think it's the stories. I think it's the way we did our writing, it's the way we developed the storylines. And that's what you will get from Mother's Love. That's what you will get. It's the authentic human stories that we told. And that's what I'm trying by God's grace. I know if you others too are at that point in this industry right now, that's what we're trying to get back to. And then we'll start slowly, build the stories back, and then start to get the money to now start blowing up the production value. Even the production value right now in Mother's Love is a lot, it's good. But I know that it could have been way bigger and better if I had the kind of funds that I really wanted. Don't forget, I was just on vacation. I just used my vacation money to do this project. So imagine what I can do if I had more. So I'm just glad from where we're starting. And I'm glad that, you know, so far the feedback we'll be getting as the story is great. That's where to start from. I think that's where you will get an old Nollywood with a spicy new time from. And then we can merge all of that, bring the technology, bring the finance, and keep it authentic still. And then we'll that'll be a good mix. And I think we'll be unstoppable. Then Afrobeat will be begging to be part of our work. Trust me, it will happen.
Yeah, there's that. It's funny because we, the other guest we had was saying that that's the issue. Like, film is the vessel. And then with film, there's supposed to be fashion infused. There's supposed to be food infused. There's supposed to be music. And for some reason, it's everybody. Yeah.
And we were the first ones to actually carry all of this on our backs. Exactly, yeah. To be honest. Because I remember the first time when we were invited to some kind of meet and greet or something of that nature in New York. We didn't even know the power that we had at the time. And I remember they had brought us to New York, and then they took us to Dallas to go do some meet and greet. And these guys in New York, they didn't know that we're not going to be there at the time. They were all there. And these are Africans. I'm not talking Africans and people from the Caribbean. They didn't know we were going to be coming back. And even we didn't know they were waiting for us. So there was this disconnect. Oh my God. They tore up that place. It was the Marriott, you know, or something of that nature where was that in New York? Anyway, they tore up the place. The NYPD was everywhere. Like, it was a shutdown. The city was on shutdown. And so we got back in the city. We thought like something big was happening. Like, oh my God, police everywhere. And then we found out it was because of us. That was the first
time. I remember this. Yeah.
It was a big deal. Yeah. That was the first time it dawned on us. Like, what, that big? Us, but the ones shutting down the whole city. Hey, damn, this is what? This was what, 2003, 2001, or some of that, early days. So it was a shock that we could shut down New York. And this was not Nigerians. This were like Africans, like Kenyans, people from Guyana, like Barbados, like other African countries and the Caribbean, and some Americans. And we shut down the whole of New York. Afrobeat didn't do that at the time. No, it was Nollywood. We're coming back to that.
Yeah.
We're coming back to that.
You're right. Because honestly, I grew up in the U.S. So my memory was begging my cousins in Nigeria, please bring back
cities.
Something with your name. I didn't even say, this actress. I said, their stories. I don't care. bring it. Yes. And we would sit. And it was like literally my memories as a child was like with my cousin, we'd sit and we watched movies you guys were in. Like, right. I don't remember being like, oh, this, I want to hear this song. Like, I just remember the movie. So I'm hoping that resurgence comes back with that, you know, and I'm seeing it in interesting ways.
Yes, it is. It is coming back. And also, you don't forget that also I do music.
Yes.
So this is a very big part of filmmaking for me. Luckily, just from the viewing we just did before coming on your podcast, it was a lot of influencers in that. And one of the things that they said was, oh my God, the music in this movie. So I can't wait for you guys to watch it.
Yeah.
And so that's, you know, the director, James, who did Harder to Fall.
Mm-hmm.
He's also a singer. He's Seal's younger brother.
Yeah.
And he's found a very interesting way to merge film and music that he does. I think it's intriguing. That's something I've always wanted to do. So of course I'll be doing that. Or like Barbara Streisand, like what she does. So those are my inspirations. Those are the people that are already doing what I want to do.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I will be mixing music and film. And so musicals, even when it's not musicals, just expressing through music, it is definitely going to be part of the fabric of all my films, for sure.
I wanted to ask one last question before we transition to our rapid fire. There was a little tiff, no pun intended, recently about, you know, having to dance to promote your movie, right? Or your films. What are your, and I want us to not, because it's not necessarily just a gisty thing, but I really do want to get your perspective because, and I don't want anybody to drag me personally, but I do think when I sit back to think about the nuance that's being spoken about, is you can give respect to the people who do the dancing. And who have fought because they have, you know how much work it takes to build. We know that.
Yeah.
But there does seem to be like a watering down. I'm not saying those people who are dancing are the ones doing it, but that there does seem to be a watering down that I think that the people who take the art form seriously are saying like, man, if I gotta have to do that, let me just retire because this is that your perspective?
It's a thing.
Yeah.
It's a thing. It's taken a very dangerous turn. I hope people begin to understand. Well, it's just not me. You have a lot of thespians in the industry who are now kicking back against us. And it's not like we don't dance. Are you kidding me? I did Celebrity Takes Two. Yeah. That's a whole show on dance, you know. So I dance. I enjoy it. It's a form of life. Who doesn't dance? You know, even if you don't know how to dance, you will shake now, you know. So I dance. It's not the problem. But the problem is not understanding that. And I don't even know what the issue is about zoning in on dance. Because I think what matters is just you doing social media skits, yeah, you know, and promos. Yeah, yeah. I thought that was what it was about until where it became this dance. And I'm like, what is it about the dance? Why does it have to be just that? You know, there are so many things you can do to promote this movie or whatever movies you're promoting at the time. There's so many other ways, so many other tactics, so many other, even if it's just social media, there are skits, there are, so many ways, comedy, there's so many things, and there's nothing wrong with dance either. But when you now start saying, oh, it just has to be dance. Oh, why won't you dance? The zoning in on that is a lot. And you have to understand that not everybody can do that. Not everybody can do that. God bless the people who can do that. Most of them, it's something that they're used to or they like. But what about people who don't know how to? What about people who don't like to? What about people who are too old to even do that? Some older artists don't even use social media. Do we risk, which is already happening in my industry, I don't want to talk too much, but now it's almost like official sometimes in some, when you're bringing us a movie that is almost as, from what I hear, that some people even put it in the contracts. Like, you're going to do this, you're going to dance, you're going to dance.
Oh, yeah. That's an odd thing to put in a contract.
I do think.
So it's odd. It's okay to do it and do anything else that you want to do. Do you guys have to dance to promote this podcast?
No. Not yet.
Not yet.
I'm not. Okay? I come from the old school. I actually trained in my real life as one.
As a dancer?
Yeah, as I did. But like, I'm not going to now whip it up for and you just guys. Because
it's okay if you feel like it. And I don't know why people think that because you guys they're talking about it, that, oh, you should go to dance. If I feel like dancing tomorrow, I will dance.
Yeah.
It's not a big deal for me. And that's what I'm trying to say. Like, don't pressure me. Don't tell me that's the only way to promote my film. Don't tell me that's what I have to do. Some might say, oh, if you don't even dance, your film is not going to sell. It's okay. It's my money. I need borrow money to do the film. It's okay. But my point is, let people feel, don't take the joy of projects from them. Don't make them feel like, oh my God, if I don't do this to please people, I'm in trouble. Mm. Don't do that. It's not, we go through a lot as filmmakers. It's a lot. Let people enjoy the art of filmmaking and let them promote and express themselves the best way they can. The people that made this fun for you, they did that because they wanted to do that. Nobody forced them to do that. So let other people do whatever they want to do, and whatever result they get is fine also.
Yeah.
It's okay. Success means different things to different people.
Yeah.
The fact that you think money is success does not mean money is success to someone else. You don't know if just going to Tifa is my own success.
Yeah, I was going to ask, what is success for you with this movie?
For this movie, it's already successful. Do you know what it means for you to just go on vacation and stumble into shooting a film? That your heart is beating and you're thinking, oh my God, I probably would never release this because, you know, who knows? It might just not be good enough to now get into go to TIFF. Do you know what it means? And then I just came back from PAF yesterday. I've been to Silicon Valley. Like, who? What? My debut movie? I'm grateful.
Yeah.
It is already a success for me. So anything else is just icing on the cake. The money I spent to shoot this movie, don't worry about it. It was chop chop money. So anything, the monetaries that, you know, that comes after that, I am grateful. But I never do anything for money. If I did things for money, I would not be where I am today. I never do anything for money. I do things for the joy of it, the passion and what I can achieve and the lines that I can move, the ceilings that I can smash with that, the legacy that I can leave behind. So those are my inspiration for doing anything. Can I make a difference here? Can I change something?
That's what gives me joy. And that's why you don't see me all the time, because I go find that inspiration. I go find what gives me joy. When I find it and I come back, you can't change my mind.
Yeah.
You can't change my mind. I stay focused and I do it for that reason. And if anything else comes after, if I get gifts, if I get money, if I get any kind of accolades, awards, anything, then that's just the icing on the cake. The real cake is I got satisfaction for doing it my way.
Yeah.
I want to talk about why aunties are so important to African history. Aunties represent curators of the African experience, and oftentimes they have been unacknowledged. They have literally held our archives before they were archives. They were literally institutions before we had institutions. They held so many important cultural artifacts, such as the way we braid our hair, the recipes of our cookings. They represent abundance. There's literally a reason why we call an African culture rich aunties. And we believe that with partnering with Anthony, we're able to showcase this type of history through art. So to connect to African history and get a piece of the Anthony and Afropolitan collection called Auntie, make sure to click the link in the description. And this is your way you can support our channel.
Quick break. You know how we're always talking about sending money back home? The diaspora sent home last year $20 billion just in Nigeria alone, right? A lot of that money goes to partying, Ashobi, maybe building a house that you only visit twice a year. Meanwhile, some of us are in Lagos watching Tesla stock go up 15% and not being able to have access to it. I don't think that that's right. And I feel like that's one of the reasons that we've partnered with Hisa. With Hisa, you can sit on your couch and invest in US stocks, crypto, ETFs in the Kenyan and the Nigerian market, right? And no longer you sitting there and watching other people get rich off investing and you're not able to get access to it because some brokerage firm in the US thinks that your VPN is suspicious activity. They've partnered with Alpaca that allows them to be licensed, legit, and you don't have to trust somebody on a WhatsApp group saying, send me money and I'll invest. Download Hisa, use code Afropolitan. Stop letting your money sit there while you argue about Naira on Twitter. All right, back to it.
You know how every week we sit down with people who've done it? People who've built, people who've led movements, people who've created culture. What if you could do more than just listen to them? That is why we built Convo by Afropolitan. On Convo, you're able to book one-on-one video calls with in-demand experts from Africa and the diaspora. Go to convo.vip to get access to your next mentor, because sometimes one convo can change your entire path. So we're going to transition to our rapid fire segment where the question we ask you, the first thought that comes into your mind, that's the one we want, right? Why is legacy so important to you?
Because when I'm gone, that's the only thing you hold on to. You wouldn't think or remember how much I had, how much I made, how much I spent. It would be what I stood for.
300 films, right? 300 movies. Gun to your head. One performance that defines you.
Gun to my head?
Yeah, if you had to choose one.
You know, it's even a movie that is not as big as so many movies that people know. It's called a movie called My Story.
My story.
Yes, my performance in that movie makes me very happy. I went from being a young girl to an old woman of like 70 something years old, and I think I knocked it out of the park. Go find that movie, My Story.
My Story,
okay.
Yes, that's the movie.
You said you'd play Funmilayo Razumekuti if you could play anyone in history. What is it about her?
I feel like we share a lot of things in common. Not like I'm comparing myself to her, like she's a legend. It's the stubbornness. I think we have that kind of spirit together. It's the stubbornness. I understand her. I really do. And I understand where she was at that time in her mind and what propelled her, what kept her going. I haven't even done anything close to what she has done, but if I could live any life, anybody's life, maybe in a more sexy way, it will be her life.
Yeah.
And if I had the opportunity, I would love, it would be an honor to portray her.
Yeah.
I'm even afraid to say it. Like, it's heavy in my mouth. I adore her and everything she stood for, the resistance she stood for. You can't take it for granted. Yeah. At that time,
Your daughter, Maria, shares your same birthday. And also, happy belated birthday, by the way.
Thank you.
But what did you guys get for each other since you both shared the same birthday?
What did we what?
Get for each other, like gifts. Do you guys give each other gifts? Yes.
Ay, ay, ay. So I can't share gifts in public. I don't like to.
Yeah.
I hardly even post family gifts in public. I just feel like those are things I want to keep private, yes. But we did get, we always try to know what someone wants. We we'll act like we don't know and then we just surprise you with it. But most importantly, we feel like I did something that's on my birthday. I spent my birthday for her. So my birthday, I celebrated actually doing something that is very important to her. She knows what I'm talking about. Yeah. And so that, for me, that was my biggest gift to her. So I wasn't celebrating myself or me on my birthday. I was actually doing something that was needed for her. And yeah, it was very special.
I love it.
Yes.
So I have a question before the last question, which is Nollywood or Hollywood?
Both. I can't pick one or the other. Nollywood made me. Hollywood will elevate me.
Oh, that's to help you complete that one.
What do you want to say?
I said Nollywood made me. Hollywood paid me.
Oh, Hollywood paid me. Yeah, they almost said pay me, but
it felt like it rhymed.
True though. That can actually work. Hollywood paid me.
Yeah.
One day I'll say that.
Yes.
But for now they're paying. It's okay.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah. But I think elevates because it's a global stage. We can't beef it. Let's be honest. It's the pinnacle of our career, isn't it? So I want to believe that one day I will be lifting up my Oscar very soon by God's grace.
Amen.
And then it will be all worth it, you know. And if it never comes, but it will come. So let's leave it at that.
I love it. So the last question we ask every single guest on the Afropolitan podcast is, who do you want to see in that chair and whose story you think needs to be told?
Jeez, I should have watched all your episodes before so that I know if they're already in this chair, because you guys have spoken to a lot of people.
No, we still have a long way to go, though. Yeah.
Who would I like to see in this chair? Ay, ay, ay. This on the spot questions. Who would I love to sit in this chair? Jeez, can we come back to that question? I don't want to give a.
It's the last question, so just
no. Reply. It can't be the last question. You haven't asked me about my movie.
Yeah. No,
we did.
Mother's Love.
We did ask about Mother's Love. We talked about it.
You haven't even talked about when it's coming out. No.
Wait, the debut in Lagos, the premiere in Lagos, March 6th.
The first
week of March. Premiere is 1st of March. Okay. But the cinema. It goes to the cinema March 6th.
Yeah. No, so we'll put all that in the description. That in the details. Trust me, your story will get people say, hey, what's going on? And they'll go watch it. Trust me.
I mean, we're going to have to go watch it anyway.
Yeah, I now need to. I have to you see have it. To. Yeah, I have to
I
see
don't
it.
Know who I want to see in your chair. Why am I like this, though?
You're not watching anybody. You're not watching TV. You know.
But maybe there's an OG. Out. Maybe there's an OG person that you're like, Yeah, it doesn't have to be new.
Oh, it doesn't have to be, It doesn't have to be in your industry. It could be anywhere.
It could be anybody,
Oh, really? Okay. You know the senator who had the thing with...
Stop it. Stop it right there. Stop it right there.
I hope you're afraid of what I'm saying?
No.
What is even her name? Her name. Okay, sorry. I thought you were talking about someone else senator we're talking about which today. Senator? The one that was rubbing the South African girl's legs. Okay, let's just move on.
Sorry.
It's not a political show anyway, so it's cool.
What that lady's been
Natasha, like? Natasha.
Natasha.
Yeah, Natasha. Yeah.
You want to see her story?
I would love to have her.
I think,
me too.
I would like to hear her talk boldly about some things.
Yeah.
I would like to hear her
talk. I see similarities between you and her, though.
You do?
Yeah.
That rebellion is.
Yeah, so that's Senator Natasha. Yeah. I would like to see her in this chair. I would like to see her have a no holds barred
conversation
about what her truth is. I think that would be nice for a lot of young girls to actually hear and know where her strength comes from and where she's at, actually, in everything. I've not followed her story much, but I would like to actually even know what is happening. And I think she's someone who will be very, at least, hopefully, be truthful.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Mm-hmm. I would like to see
her. We would love
that.
To have her.
Yeah, I'd like to have her.
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
So
much.